and that's Sugar Minot, well-known Jamaican reggae artist. And as soon as I start spinning that around, in a moment, after we hear a little more about America here from the Nice, we'll do that. By the way, the views and opinions expressed on this program have been those of the participants and selected others, and not necessarily those of the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I'll be back next week. Stay tuned for Music for Human Beings after some Sugar Minot coming up oh so shortly here on WMBR in Cambridge.
Showtime Jamaican something else. في Music for Human. I am الدكتور جالس السكران, and other whales are wailing because we are underwater today. Yes, it was our intention for many years to do an underwater broadcast, but until recently the technology did not match the spirit. Our connection with you is a feat of technology, and with us are other feats of spirituality. We welcome Aurora. Aurora, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show again today, Dr. Jalis. And for the underwater spirituality. It is often difficult for people who have never been underwater to learn how to feel at peace in the same way they are in the air.
There is discomfort. There is an attitude that it is difficult to breathe the water, and therefore one feels that life is threatened.
And it is merely a trick of the mind that one must learn. For when one learns to breathe with one's soul and with one's mind, rather than with one's nose, then one can be comfortable and know that they are not near death. They are indeed near life.
Well, Aurora, as always, it is wonderful to be here with you.
And it is wonderful to be here with you.
And just now entering the water is Professor Levine. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me once again, Dr. Jalis and Aurora and everyone else.
The whales are wailing.
The whales are wailing, and I find that they usually wail for very good cause. But I have to say, for my own self, today I am not wailing. I am wailing in pleasure and joy at being with you once again.
The pleasure, of course, Professor, is mutual. But not only for being in communion with you, but also in communion with the whales.
Yes, and with the musicians who are playing the music that we listen to, even though it has been recorded in the past, I feel that we have some connection with them. And this past week I've been traveling internationally. I was attending a New Age spirituality conference in Sweden. And I always feel when I travel internationally that I get a deeper sense of the nature of humanity, since I can view different behavior across cultures and I can see what we all have in common. And I can say that we all have some kind of beauty. Here in the United States, it's a very deep inner beauty that often is veiled, whereas in Sweden, it's a very natural beauty that one sees upon people's faces very easily. There's just a natural grace and beauty that the people of Sweden possess and they exude. And I do have to say that at first when I arrived in Sweden, I was a bit upset because seeing all these beautiful people, and really it was a much larger number of beautiful people and a much higher degree of beauty than I had ever witnessed before. So at first I thought, my presence here is merely lowering the average beauty of this country significantly, and perhaps I should just leave. Then after speaking to a few Swedes, I realized that Swedes recognize and appreciate both external beauty and inner beauty.
Inner beauty, of course, valued there because it is so rare.
Indeed, and external beauty is sort of like
it's
a commodity almost. It's like metal, whereas inner beauty is like silver and gold and diamonds.
It is really an excellent analogy. Here, under the water, it is difficult to think of the birds, though we know they are there. No, instead we think of the fish. When I am on land, I often fear that I will be struck by a bicycle. And here the fear is instead that I will be accidentally struck by a harpoon or a very, very swift fish.
Yes. Well, anyway, on my return, I was thinking about the nature of humanity, and I came across the following theorem, which I now propose to you and as well as our listeners. And this theorem is the following, that the total amount of beauty possessed by each individual person is equal. That all human beings are equal in their beauty. This beauty is merely distributed across different attributes of the human being in different ways.
By that thought, then, you would say that deep inside an ugly person is much more beauty than would be expected inside a prettier person.
Yes, as a sum total, but there are many types of internal beauty. There is not merely one kind. There is beauty of kindness. Mm. There is beauty of cleverness. There is beauty of the ability to create and solve Rubik's Cubes. The ability to grow beautiful mustaches. The ability to grow beautiful forearm hair and braid it into beautiful patterns.
Well, that's an interesting and wonderful thought, but the downside of that is that everyone has equal amounts of ugliness.
Well, ugliness, of course, is merely the absence of beauty, and I think that the total sum of beauty of every human being is 100%.
It is an interesting belief. I remember certain characters in my life upon whom I think this analogy, this description you make, would rest on shaky ground. In my experience, there are people who are beautiful on the surface and empty inside. This I have seen. But I have also met very angry, unattractive people who, it seems, the deeper I searched, the more ugliness I found.
Yes, well, I think we have to be a little careful when we distinguish between inner and outer beauty. Being kind on the surface and being sparkling in one's personality itself is actually a form of outer beauty, not inner beauty, since it is exposed on the surface and easily apparent.
So it may, I will allow, be that I performed the analysis poorly.
Well, I think perhaps for certain people the problem is that the beauty that they have, that raw resource, is hidden very deep inside and is enclosed by many layers of impure husks. And this is an idea which I actually draw from the Jewish mystical tradition, which states that all things have inner mystical sparks which may be hidden by outer husks of impurity and thus may be very hard to discern. And I think in the case of those individuals, their inner beauty was hidden from you as well as from themselves, most likely, and it would have taken a great deal of effort to expose it. But this is a belief which is very tightly connected with the idea that salvation and redemption is possible for all human beings, since they always retain that mass of hidden beauty, no matter how corrupted they become.
I see. So well, the value.
I would also say that it is possibly often that someone who looks less than beautiful on the outside would be insulted and so put down by those around them, those who cannot see the inner beauty, that they begin to lose their inner beauty and comply.
No. It's driven deep inside, underneath many layers of hardened shells.
Yes, that's exactly what I meant.
Yes.
So they begin to lose it within themselves.
Well, it's within themselves, but it becomes hidden and hard to expose. And I think re-exposing it is always possible, but may be very difficult.
No. It is against the harsh air of criticism and those around us that we grow a skin around our souls. Mm.
And for those individuals, if they indeed die in this state where their inner beauty is surrounded by a deep shell and hard exterior, then they must undergo reincarnation to achieve that opening up of the beauty once again. And this is connected to my deep belief in salvation and redemption for all mankind.
I have often found that it can be easier to create a new persona and to put yourself into that persona, one that is calmer, that is more centered, for about an hour a week, and then slowly grow your persona until you can become that person at any time, and that will allow yourself to be free. Then you can control your desires, you can control your mental state, and be more in tune with those around you.
Yes, and this is why it's very well known that actors, celebrities such as, you know, Brad Pitt, Tom Cruise, Mel Gibson, are actually some of the most enlightened human beings on Earth because of this ability to reshape themselves at will.
And it's also a pitfall that many actors fall into a single role, and then they can only put themselves into that persona.
That's right. That does occur to, I think Steve Buscemi has had that problem a bit.
But after some, I'm sure, attention or spiritual investigation or meditation, it may be possible to resurrect one's beauty. I wonder, though, Professor Devine, is this restricted because we mention physical beauty as a type of beauty? Is it possible that in a certain ugly person physically, that they would also have within them simply a gem or a very, very nice arrangement of bodily organs, and then therefore have no spiritual beauty whatsoever?
Well, I think we all have enough beauty as a sort of raw material to allow us to expose and have that beauty manifested in various ways, including both the physical, the internal physical, as in the arrangement of the spine, the vertebrae, and the liver, and the kidneys, as well as on the exterior, the number of fingers that we possess, and our nose, and our cheeks, and so on. But let me just sort of step back a bit and say that I believe that those individuals who achieve spiritual beauty on the outside, that they somehow expose and manifest their spiritual raw material as kindness and genuine being, authenticity, they ipso facto become physically attractive, whether or not they are inherently beautiful or not. Somehow that spiritual radiance shadows over their looks, and when we see them, we merely are bowled over by their beauty. I think Gandhi matches this description. Although he himself, taken by himself, he was not a physical beauty, those who met him have said that a certain glow radiated from his face, from his punim, and it affected their perception of him so that they would actually view him as a beautiful person.
And so this naturally would detract from his spiritual beauty, or it would combine?
No, I think it combines, and as I said, I think we all have enough of a stock of the raw beauty material that it's enough to just sort of, it's usually so underutilized by all human beings, it's so trapped inside these shells, this inner core, that we all are capable of so much more beauty than we actually ever see.
I would say it emanates from the inner beauty. From what Professor Levine has been saying, that this inner beauty can surround the person's physicality and bring a glow almost to that person. An attractive glow, one cannot help but be pulled to this person.
I do understand this. Well, if you would like to bring to us an attractive glow, the number is 617-253-8810, and we would like to be in each other's glow. Caller, marhaban.
Yeah, hi. This is Scott from Cambridge.
Yes, welcome, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, Scott.
You've got me thinking of aesthetics and the criteria for beauty.
Yes.
And you're underwater.
Yes.
So you've got me thinking of coral, where you're wondering what is beautiful aesthetically, whereas one ocean would have coral, and you'd be underwater, and the fish would be on the background of shimmering light and stuff like that, of coral, whereas off of our coast, it's a different view.
Indeed it is. I have often wondered, see, this issue about the being able to relax and appreciate the beauty that is there, it can be very challenging if one has fear. With fear, one can see the coral as a prison or as an attack, as a terrible, vicious thing. Let us bring
voice. The coral seashells that when you
see. Yes, but once again, it could be vicious, regarded as vicious by a person who is afraid.
If your submarine goes into the coral, but I don't see your analogy. The coral is like petrified things.
Let's bring another petrified thing on the air with us now.
Cool.
Caller 2, marhaban.
Excuse me?
Caller, welcome.
I was just wondering, not this song, but the last song you guys just played, I was wondering what that was.
The last, I will direct the the musicologist, if possible.
Yeah, while
he's doing that, I would really like to address the first question, which was about seeing beauty and underwater, and I just came back from a dive, and hello? While I was under there, I have very poor eyesight, so my glasses were off, and I was swimming in the water, and I realized how beautiful and how serene everything is. Especially with my poor eyesight, everything melts together and is smooth and was without imperfection. And so what can be beauty in the coral can also be beauty at the beach when you're surrounded by sand and grasses. Everything, in its own way, is beautiful, especially if you allow yourself to see its surroundings, its ecosystem, how the grasses feed the fish or the snails.
The musicologist.
Yes, this is Professor Levine acting. Our musicologist has contacted me to let me know that we were playing a CD, a compact disc, by the name of Ambientism. Ambientism Volume 1, that's the name of the compact disc. And in particular, the artist that created the first track, which we played, was 01.
01?
01 was the name of the artist, yes, featured on the CD. And the name of the song that we were playing by 01 was Dream World.
Dream World?
Yes.
That sounds cool. Thank you very much. It's such an interesting song. I had to call there. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for listening and for sharing the moment with us. It is like a dream world here underwater. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you'd like, remain on the line, and we will share the confusion. Is there a terror? Is it possible to be afraid of? I remember at one point in time, I was nurturing an underwater garden. I had been enamored, Scott, if you are still there, of the seaweed. I found it to be very attractive. And after much scientific and spiritual investigation to see why the seaweed was limited in its growth, I discovered that it was due to a deficiency in iron that prevented the seaweed from proliferating further. So I seeded the area with iron pellets, and indeed the seaweed began to grow and to proliferate until there was a hairiness of seaweed on the floor of the small ocean sample. And it seemed suddenly no longer to be beautiful. It seemed vicious and wicked. It was as though I was beholding a sea full of cockroaches.
I take a lot of iron. I don't really trip off of it. I trip off other things. How much iron can you? I take a lot of iron, actually. If you're ever afraid of anything, I guess the best thing to do is find another human being and come together with that human being in some way. The iron in the seaweed.
Indeed, the iron. I discovered.
Okay. Well. Here's where it would be my part. That might scare you, right? But some fish might not.
Yes. So I
would have to take the iron, and you would have to take the fish that I'm not particularly careful.
I think that's a good point. I mean, that Scott makes, which is that the thing that. That strikes fear in the heart of one individual, another individual thinks of as a beautiful thing to be accepted. So if you have two individuals together who complement each other, then thing which would make one person afraid can now be neutralized by two people together.
And I absolutely agree. My point was that it is all about the attitude of the receiver. The experience of fear in my mind prevented me from appreciating the beauty of the sea of seaweed.
Well, one must be careful. Oftentimes people think that any emotion that is felt by one person can be shared by another. But it is often the case that when fear is shared, it is amplified rather than subdued.
Well, I think that there's this personality trait which has been studied by New Age psychologists, which is I forget the word for it, but it's basically our exploratory property. And some people have the exploratory property in spades, and they love to explore things that are unusual and different, and they're never afraid. They're always intrigued, and they want to explore. So they might see this bed of seaweed and just say, wow, this is so strange and alien that I must explore it. Whereas others like those things which are familiar to them, and they are afraid by the things that are different. And they may think, well, Boston is familiar to me, and I want to stay here, and I am afraid of anything which is a bit different. And that's okay, I think. It's okay for some people to be more geared towards exploration, and others to be more geared towards focusing on what they know.
And there is beauty in both attitudes.
Yes, and I think the thing is that exploration can actually be cultivated and nurtured, that if one generally is fearful of new situations, one can overcome this fear in some ways by dipping their toe in the water a bit and finding friends who are naturally explorer types and venturing out with them and finally feeling that they have confidence to explore that which is different and new and unusual. And I hope all our callers, you know, sometimes can get this instinct of exploration and be willing to explore what is new and different and normally fearful to them.
Indeed.
But I did have a coral experience myself. I was in Hawaii off the coast and swimming with some scuba gear. Did I say scuba deer?
I believe, indeed, I was.
An underwater scuba deer. No, just gear. And I was exploring a coral and I was gazing at its beauty. And then as I swam, my leg brushed against the coral. And it turns out that corals are extremely sharp, razor sharp, and they also have this kind of bacteria on them which can be kind of somewhat poisonous to the human skin, not in a very serious way, but it can cause a bit of irritation like poison ivy. So I did experience some discomfort as a result of this coral, but I made sure that the experience didn't turn me off to corals in general, because I think corals can be a very beautiful experience.
The stingray was actually the fish that I was thinking of.
Ah, the stingray, yes. Beautiful fish, yet so dangerous.
Everything has beauty and danger in it. You can die from a stingray. You can die from a piece of paper if it cuts you in the wrong place.
Yes, cuts you in the heart.
Indeed, my experience with beauty and danger is that they often come together.
The femme fatale.
Indeed.
Yes, I think we've all had some experience with the femme fatale.
It can be very challenging, but also in nature, those things which are the most to be feared, if one can dissociate one's experience from the fear, aesthetically, it can be extremely.
Well, I wonder
engaging.
if our callers, if either of them has ever had this experience of being afraid of that which is different and then somehow overcoming that fear and learning something new and really augmenting themselves by exploration.
And are both of our callers still with us?
We seem to perhaps have lost them.
I hear the lingering echoes of at least one. Caller, are any of you with us?
Oh, yeah, I prefer you to go to the next caller. Do you wear glasses?
At times.
Yeah. I got glasses towards middle age. I didn't have them until the beginning of middle age.
But if anyone with, or indeed without glasses, would like to join us, the number is 617-253-8810.
Yes, and we'd love to hear about any personal experience involving overcoming fears, learning to explore that which is new, as well as exposing and finding some inner beauty within ourselves of which we were not previously aware.
And we love callers both who are beautiful outside and those who are beautiful only inside.
And we love them in all the various ways that one human can love another.
But in the meantime, indeed we are enjoying this special underwater broadcast of Music for Human. It is indeed a bizarre experience.
I must speak from the perspective of a vocal therapist. That underwater, one cannot speak. One can make limited sounds. And yet everything sounds so much closer.
It is why the whole experience is so especially bizarre.
As one from the desert, I'm sure that growing up, did you have few experiences with being
very
submerged?
Very few, very few. I only learned, of course, to swim in adulthood. It is, I think, analogous to being surrounded as I am in water. It is much like a person who was poor for their whole lives may experience the sensation of swimming in a sea of pennies.
What I've heard is that those who have been born and raised in that region of the world in the Middle East often actually learn how to swim first in the sand of the deserts as a sort of proxy or simulacrum for the waters of the ocean.
Indeed, it was so, but very few people are able to tolerate even a small amount of sand in the lungs, whereas many are able to survive briefly with water there.
Especially fish.
Indeed, indeed. Or the mythical sand salamander.
I would like to mention to those of you who are having difficulty with water in the lungs that there are simple vocal exercises which can be done underwater, even if you cannot make those sounds. Even though you cannot sing, try singing underwater, because it's the same breath patterns that you need for swimming, the sharp intake and then the slow exhale.
And of course, it's not widely known, but is in fact true, that most human beings in the fetal state, while they are developing in the womb of their mother through the various stages of development, actually do hum to themselves. And they sing a very beautiful song, and this is a song which science has not yet been able to record. And it's thought that this song is actually the source and the root of all music that humans love and enjoy, and that if somehow this fetal song could be captured and could be explored and its essence could be distilled, that eventually war would dissipate and all humans would love another.
Naturally recurring and of course returning to the human primal language, what the modern linguists call the universal language.
Right, the universal grammar.
Indeed.
Of the fetus.
The fetal universal grammar, or the FUG.
Yes, the FUG, yes. And of course, the reason which we often play the whale music, the whale language, is that here at Music for Human, we have a strong belief that by understanding whale communication and whale music, eventually we can start to uncover this fetus universal grammar, the fetal grammar, and eventually by understanding that fetal hum, the fetal sound, the fetal music, eventually the world will become a place where no man strikes another and there is peace and love.
Indeed.
For all.
Indeed. I think that part of the theory there is that the reason that one is able to strike another is that in spite of a later knowledge that one has to relearn, that the fetus coming from the womb increases the vocabulary but slowly loses the ability to recognize in the speech of others its own speech. And so in time the fetus begins to believe that it is the center of the universe, a god, a single point, until eventually the fetus is able to recognize in others some shadow of itself, which is the shadow of the original knowledge that it is part of a single humanity. And it is in the hope of recovering this knowledge that we seek the understanding of the universal grammar of the fetus.
Yes, and of course this explains many strange phenomena which I've always wondered about, and that is the fact that babies and young children are very, very selfish creatures, or so they seem, and that's because they have yet to relearn the lesson that other human beings are like them and are themselves worthy of respect and attention and love. And I think that's why parenting can be such a beautiful chore. It's difficult, but the fact that you are teaching a human being so much and exposing so much of their beauty is really quite striking.
See, this is interesting because my explanation for the selfishness of a child is that children are so pure and are so spiritually connected with the world as it really is that they realize we are just one creature, but the logic stops there. And they think, if I am everything, then I am the most important. I need what I want.
Well, I really love this train of thought because that leads us to the idea that real, authentic kindness and recognition of humanity itself is a sort of spiritually amazing selfishness, because it's merely the recognition that we are all one, we have the same ego, and thus we must all be treated with respect. And so, in a certain sense, the idea of giving to others breaks down in the highest form and becomes merely an act of selfishness.
And I'd also like to point out that what is so terrifying about this is those early memories, which we cannot recover naturally. They are wiped out by the trauma and the brainwashing of being separate beings, but we are told repeatedly, and it is enforced, that we are not the same as the one next to us. And this can be so traumatizing that we must forget the singularity in order to live.
Well, also, I have to say that I believe this explains the fact that human beings require so much time to physically develop. Of course, many other animals come out of the womb and are immediately fully physically mature, whereas human beings start totally incapable of feeding or moving or striking. If it were the case that human beings came out fully formed, then those little children would be the most vicious and dangerous criminals in the world. And so this is sort of a self-preservation mechanism that we somehow need to immobilize the youngest so that they don't become real massive terrors to all mankind. And you could imagine a very terrifying world where the young, the infants, were all murderers and killers and thieves and rapists. And I think some movies sometimes touch into that fear, like these movies about these evil little children who murder.
Well, why is it then that children are not allowed to speak? Because I feel as though a baby who has just experienced childbirth could then say to us all of those mysteries which we have, could tell us about the origin of life, the beginning of life, and tell us about spirituality as they experience it, having been most recently physically part of another person.
Yes, so this is of course the same idea as the idea that I am exploring in my own scientific studies of trying to record that fetal universal grammar, that humming music, that melody. And somehow I think nature hid it from us for a reason. I don't quite know why.
I have a theory. Let us share it perhaps with a caller. The number is 617-253-8810. Caller, marhaban.
Hello, what time does your program begin?
The program?
Yes.
We begin at 7 p.m., caller.
On Fridays.
And caller, you are actually on the air at the moment.
I'm on the air on the moment. It's very nice to be on the air.
It is nice also to be on the air with you, caller.
How are you?
Caller, I am well. I am deeply excited about being both underwater and on the brink of understanding, I think, with Professor Levine here, this fetal universality. My theory is that the universality, the reason it cannot be communicated, is that the transition from birth to life is similar to the transition from life to death. That the certain wisdoms are granted to one upon the transition, but they are unable to communicate them to those who are in the middle state.
So life itself is a middle state?
It is a middle state between
pre-birth and post-birth.
Pre-life and post-life.
I see. So, caller, is this the first time that you've tuned in to Music for Human Beings? Have we lost the new caller?
It may indeed be so. But as to why nature has constructed such an arrangement, I think that it is not a malicious arrangement, simply that for one's consciousness to operate, one must not be aware of these universals. They are too powerful. Mm. Let us join with one of our fellow people. Caller, welcome. Please, if you can, step away from the radio.
Hello?
Yes, welcome. Welcome, caller.
Hello?
Caller, welcome.
Hello?
Caller, yes, hello.
Caller, can you hear us?
Yes.
Excellent. Could you perhaps turn down your radio if it is on?
Yeah, I did. I'm
excellent.
In a car.
I think cars itself themselves, the fact that we can move through the universe in a little capsule is an amazing feat. And I often think that I have these dreams where I am moving through all the dimensions of the universe, the physical, the non-physical, the non-non-physical, and the semi-physical, in a little capsule of a bubble, a sort of bubble all around me.
In a metallic womb, so to speak.
Yes,
indeed.
Now, caller, how are you tonight?
I'm doing really well.
And how is their drive? I hope you, of course, remain focused on the road as you talk to us, but...
Of course.
Yes. Is this the first time you've called into the show?
It is, but I've listened to your show several times before.
Oh, excellent. And do you yourself have any strong views on this question of why it is that when we live as human beings, we can't be privy to the deepest secrets of the universe?
I actually like what your other colleague had to say just a little bit ago about his theory about how it's how life is just the middle between birth and death. And I've recently had an experience with death and how little the person had to say about life while he was dying.
Hmm.
I hope it is not too personal. Perhaps you could share the slight observations.
I guess I see it as when you get older, it's harder to communicate. You start losing that.
Well, perhaps it is the case
audio,
that yes,
like verbal communication, you start to lose that once you're older. While you're new, you start to gain it really slowly.
Yeah, so the way I think about this is the fact that one can be in this world to some degree, and one can be in the other world to some degree. And to the extent that one is fully in this world and fully aware of what's going on in this world, one will be less aware of the other worlds. So if one can fully communicate now, it's often very difficult to be in those other planes of existence.
Right.
Whereas those who are already have one foot in those other planes of existence, such as those who are dying, often are not able to fully communicate with those who are present here in life.
And I'd like to add that it is possible to dip your toe into this feeling if you meditate. And I keep slipping in and out of this during this program. When you are meditating, when you are concentrating and floating off into the spiritual world, you often find it very difficult to communicate not
right.
only your experiences, but in the moment with those around you.
I think there is a danger in seeking too aggressively the genuine truths, the deep truths of the universe.
Hmm.
There is a danger of being on the brink of insanity.
Yes, yes.
Like an egg. If the chick wishes before it's time to see the outside world, the egg will split and the chick will die.
Well, and of course, bringing in the Jewish tradition here, there is a story in the Talmud of four famous scholars, And the question is whether they said they had all entered what's called the orchard, where the orchard here is a metaphor for understanding the deepest secrets of existence and the universe. And it is said that one person who entered the orchard became a heretic. They lost their set of morality. They became immoral being in some way because of they weren't capable of handling that deep truth.
So they became completely faithless.
Completely faithless and immoral. The second individual who entered the orchard simply went insane. As Dr. Jalas mentioned, this is a possibility that somehow our perception of reality can become overwhelmed, and our ability to distinguish between what we observe, our perceptions, and what we imagine, that line can sometimes become too blurred if we see too much, and that can be very dangerous for our existence, our middle existence now in the world, in life. The third person simply died. They simply weren't able to continue existing at all in this earthly plane after observing these deepest mysteries. And only the fourth person was able to come back in peace. And I think there are some very few rare individuals who are capable of understanding these deep mysteries and are able to integrate them fully into their earthly lives. But this is a very rare ability.
Indeed.
You're entering into ethics. You're entering into ethics.
Ethics or epics?
Ethics. Well, ethics, like Aristotle.
Mm. Indeed.
Which is good.
Not like a Homer.
I'm sorry?
Unlike Homer.
I think what we're trying to do here is to take the poetics and the ethics and combine them into one unit.
Only through freeing the mind completely and allowing yourself to make conclusions which may seem absurd can you learn new things and new ways and reach certain realities that cannot be reached through our current logical systems.
I think, unfortunately, that there is a great possibility, even as we are entertaining these thoughts and permitting ourselves to study the unusual, that even if we did find some truth that resonated with us, others would be unable to understand, and yet others would be simply unable to comprehend.
But I think there's different degrees of these things. That it could be that one person comprehends something to one degree and another just glimpses a little bit of what's beyond the veil, but that mere glimpse can actually really be substantial and important for them in their own way.
I would argue that truth is relative. It is so subjective. And as we float off in different directions, in different ways in space, the truth that we see is different than the truth of your neighbor or your cat.
Well, I personally am, I think, unique among New Age practitioners in believing in objective reality. I do believe that there is truth. I simply think that language is fuzzy. Language is not capable of precisely describing the reality. So there are often many different ways of describing what is objectively true. And as a result, we have to be open to the fact that our way of describing reality may not correspond exactly to someone else's description, but they can both be in some way accurately describing the reality.
Well, I think there are some elements of that and other elements of simply feeling a different truth in your mind.
But I would wager that those who are criminals, like those who are evil genocidal leaders, for example, are actually obscured from the truth, that they themselves are not simply having their own relative truth, but they do not understand something.
I believe all of us do not understand many, many things, and that one of us not understanding a particular thing may relate to ourselves not understanding many thousands of things. It is difficult to measure misunderstandings as we ourselves have no objective and whole understanding.
My belief on the subjectivity issue is that if one in an extreme way, takes subjectivity completely, that one will again reach an objective reality, that in each person's complete subjectivity, this idea once again that in our unified unreality one finds a disunified reality.
I think I didn't follow that last sentence.
It's in other words, in the definition of objectivity as my personal reality, we will eventually find in within each person the same objectiveness.
There was a mathematician who once asked me, if there is a planet who sends you a picture of the night sky as seen from their planet, how would you find where they are? And all that is to trace back those stars that you see and connect them, the ones that you see with your eyes. And in the end, you take the reality of all of those around you and you can draw from them and see the point where reality lies or where those other people lie.
That's a really great thought, because that implies that the only way to capture reality is to actually interrogate the views of other human beings, that the search for truth must be a communal process.
Exactly. And I would even wager to say that you cannot just ask one person, you must ask thousands, you must gather a collective of information. And in this way, as against as I am of technology, as much as I dislike a lot of the things that have brought into life recently, the internet is amazing because it allows us a full map of so many billions of different views.
Yeah, to just put that in another way, I think this is nice because it sort of cuts against the traditional view of the man who goes off into the mountains, into the caves, and finds a reality on his own, and then perhaps later comes to share it with others. But this view says no. That man may go into the cave, into the mountain, and may understand something, but he does not fully comprehend that until he shares it with us and understands the views of others as well at the same time. And I think that's precisely what we're doing here on Music for Humans. That's our agenda, and that's what we advocate.
And of course, you can reach out physically, or you can reach out spiritually and try to touch others in a less obvious way. But of course, there are so many things that can be done in a dark cave with solitude. There are too many echoes when you surround yourself with people, and sometimes you need to go off into the distance to draw your lines on your map to find reality.
So in other words, the view of the constellations from each of us, where each of us is a planet, must first be fully articulated in our own view before it can be sort of matched with the view of the constellations from others, that we
exactly.
each have a responsibility within ourselves to look within and to find our truth, and then to take that truth and share it, and to learn from others' truths at the same time, to continue the refinement process.
You have explained this thought so clearly and so beautifully. I wonder if either of our callers have any...
This music that's playing strikes me as a sort of anthem of international solidarity of mankind.
Indeed, there have been very many great successes by our current musicologist, as well as failures this evening. And any final thoughts from our callers? Do our callers remain callers?
I believe they have also drifted off into the distance.
Drifting into a tranquility. Drifting straight into it. Straight into a tranquility. Thank you, Aurora. And it was nice talking to you.
Thank you for being back again.
It was nice also talking to you, caller.
Scott.
To the many callers who called us, we apologize for not being able to reach you. We were generated earlier this last century. Aurora, thank you, of course, for being with us.
Namaste.
And Professor Levine, once again, thank you.
Thank you so deeply.
A counter deepness to the thankness. We are Music for Human here every Friday at 7 p.m. on WMBR Cambridge 88.1 FM. We are on every Friday at 7 p.m. We thank you once again for being with us. I'm Dr. Giles Sakran. Stay tuned for Hipster Happy Hour. Ma'asalama.
For safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians and unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Head to toe, rayon, don't light a match. We look good and we're starting from scratch. Going to a place that never existed and probably never will, yeah. Oh, blue light, basement on a throwdown, autonomous zone with it in the lights. And we're well enough alone to leave your contacts at home and leave your party at the door.
Hi, welcome to another edition of Hipster Happy Hour. Can you handle the pretension? I certainly hope so, because tonight is designated post-punk night on Hipster Happy Hour. And, you know, I can't stay on track, so there are going to be plenty of other diversions coming up. Going to be playing some Y, going to be playing some Shallowby Effect, and all sorts of stuff that should by no means be on a post-punk hour show. But it's all going to be here, and more, so stay tuned. And we're going to start off with some Sleater Kane.
Watching.